What does Australia's next generation of young leaders have to say about the future of India-Australia relations in a post-COVID world? And how do Indian scholars, scientists, practitioners, and students factor in? You're listening to Shared Visions, the podcast that spotlights the Australian government's new Colombo plan and gets to the heart of these questions. Today, we speak with Ashley Eden, a student of law at La Trobe University, and Dr. Meenakshi Gopinath, the founder and director of WISCOMP, or Women in Security, Conflict Management and Peace, and the former principal of Lady Sri Ram College in New Delhi.
My name is Ashley Eden, and I am a New Colombo scholar from 2019. I was based in India, in New Delhi. I currently study a Bachelor of Law and Psychological Science, as well as a Diploma of Hindi at La Trobe University. And I am living in Bendigo, Australia at the moment, because I was sadly called home from India earlier this year.
Hi, I'm Meenakshi Gopinath, and I'm delighted to be in conversation with Ashley. I live in New Delhi. My connection with Ashley is because I worked in the college, Lady Sri Ram College, that she is affiliated with through the Colombo Plan, and it was a great pleasure to meet her. She just came by one day to say hello and opened up a whole new world to me. I work with an organization called Women in Security, Conflict Management and Peace, which looks at women's leadership in peace processes in the South Asian region. And I also currently chair the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi. I miss my days at Lady Sri Ram College, and so meeting Ashley again was really a beautiful nostalgic trip, and it was also an affirmation of the new pathways that open up for Indo-Australian collaboration, and there's so many possibilities because Ashley represents a world of possibilities. Thank you.
That's very nice. Feel very touched. Yeah. Thank you.
I guess a good place to start would be just kind of talking about your experiences, Ashley, since you came in as an exchange student, and you know you were kind of directly immersed in this, in this academic environment at Lady Sri Ram, and then you left early and everything. But if you could just touch upon your experiences and what it was like to come to India and be immersed like headfirst into it, and if you had some kind of preconceived ideas about what your experience would be like, and if that changed over time, and what kind of ideas that maybe you got from here that you then took back home.
Just start me off with a easy question, why don't you? Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, you're fine. So I started my New Colombo Plan program last year in July, July 2019. And I landed in New Delhi, and I didn't know anyone. And in terms of my expectations, I had been to India before on another study tour, so I knew sort of what to expect about India. But in terms of actually living there, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, and I just thought that there would be probably a lot of people, that it would be quite crowded at times, and that I might get a little bit overwhelmed at times. But then I also felt really excited about the possibilities of, spending an extended period of time in India and just learning about this fantastic country. And in my first couple of weeks there, I got connected to Dr. Gopinath, and we had a wonderful time at her house, and she invited me over and she gave me these great books to read and was just so incredibly welcoming and beautiful. And that sort of set the tone for my entire time in India. I was just overwhelmed by the incredible hospitality that exists in Indian culture. Throughout my time, I was in India for 9 months. I was supposed to be there for all of this year too, but I'm hoping that once COVID ends, I'll be able to return back to India and continue the rest of my NCP program. But when I was there, I did a semester at Lady Sri Ram College for Women in New Delhi. I studied Hindi in Missouri, and I undertook a couple internships with Indo Genius, as well as the Center for India and Australia Studies. So I had quite a diverse and jam-packed experience in those 9 months and did a lot of traveling around India too. So I think I got to see a lot of the beauty that India has, as well as some of the challenges that they face. And it made me really excited about the possibility of the future for Australia and India to grow in their relationship with each other. And I also just grew a lot as a person. I made such incredible friendships that I'm still keeping in touch with now, and I'm really excited to go back when that time comes.
And so you just briefly touched upon a couple of those specific projects you worked on, including Indogenius and the connecting rural and I forget exactly, it's connecting rural and international students.
Dear Chris, Connecting Rural, Regional and International Students is a project that I run back in Australia.
That's back in Australia.
Yeah, but it is international in the sense that you're trying to get students from different countries like India, like Thailand, all across the Indo-Pacific, to actually write letters to students in Australia. So it's a pen pal program. So that was a side project when I was in India. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. But was it prompted by your experience in India, or was it kind of already in motion before you got there?
It was already in motion. That project was established back in 2017, It was definitely spurred on. And, you know, I felt very encouraged because I'm having such incredible interactions with people from, you know, from different countries, from India, that have grown up with entirely different experiences than myself. And that's really at the heart of what Dear Chris, this project, this Pen Pal project is. It's connecting students in rural and regional Australia that have, you know, that don't have necessarily the opportunity to go overseas, or haven't been overseas, or haven't met someone so incredibly different to them that has grown up in a different area of the world, and connecting them with someone that does have a different worldview, and allowing them to build that connection and share ideas, and also realize that they have a lot in common.
Ashley, you know, Chris is such a fascinating initiative, and you've had, you know, you've played leadership roles right through, from the time you were in school, high school, to university. You've been on the list of the vice chancellor for being an outstanding student of your class, and so on. I was just curious, when you describe India as big, bold, and beautiful, mm-hmm. why did those sort of metaphors come up for you? It's big, but bold and beautiful would be really interesting if you could share with Ronak and me why you use those particular phrases.
Yeah, absolutely. I was inspired actually by a speech that I heard as part of what the work I was doing with the Centre for Indian Australian Studies, which was part of OP Jindal Global University. And I think that India is bold in that there are so many people, and bold links back into big, in that India is so incredibly diverse, with different landscapes, different cultures, different languages, different foods, all within the one country, that it has to be bold in its approach and how it goes about I think functioning and thriving as a country. And so you see India being bold in sport, you see India being bold and, you know, in the colors that the women wear in their saris, you see Indians being bold in their adventurous life. I saw incredibly brave and ambitious young women at Lady Shri Ram College that are top of their class and have come to New Delhi, you know, living hundreds and hundreds of miles and kilometers away from their families, but are just committed to giving it their best shot and giving it their all and to actually making it a positive difference in this world. And I think that bold, that tenacity is something that is core to Indians, that I don't think you see in all places of the world. And I think beautiful, you only need to go to India to experience its beautiful, to experience its beauty and how beautiful it is. You know, you've got snow-covered mountains, you've got historical and bustling cities, rainforests. The diversity is astounding, not to mention the diversity in its people, which I've already just touched on a little bit before.
Did you find it overwhelmingly intense, or did you find it bewildering, or did you find it, you know, because there are other metaphors you can use, you know, chaotic, unpredictable, you know, they say that for everything that's said about India, the opposite is equally true.
Yes, absolutely. So, I don't think you can make generalizations about India, they just don't work.
How did you sort of navigate your way through those contradictions? You know, for example, you talk about this big Indian wedding that you went to with your close friend Vaishnavi, if I'm not wrong.
No, yes, you're
and how incredible it was in terms of color and so on, and festivities and gaiety. And there's a beautiful picture of you in Indian clothes, looking so comfortable. I would imagine you were an Indian in a previous lifetime, if you believe in that. And yet, you know, you do see a lot of deprivation. You see, it's there in your face. You see poverty in a way in which you don't encounter it in Australia. And you see, you know, the both this rural landscapes and urban landscapes jostling for space. You see something called the new rurban, which is the sort of a kind of mixture of the rural and the urban on the margins of big cities. So how did you negotiate your way through all of those contradictions? Did you find them unpleasant at times? Did you find them bewildering? Or did you find that there was a resilience in the Indian people that allowed them to go in and out of these identities? I'm just curious.
Well, I think there absolutely is a resilience in the Indian identity that allows people to be exposed to such a harsh reality of life at times. And I was very confronted when I first arrived. And, you know, even when I was still there, you're walking along the street or you're in an Uber and there's a child beggar that's asking you for money or asking the car next to you for money. And I remember one time in particular, I was watching this little girl and she was holding on to this car, not my car, but somebody else's car. And, you know, chasing it down the street, but holding onto it in desperation that the person in the vehicle would give them some money. And it seems like that, which are absolutely horrific, and it breaks your heart. And they are really challenging to witness. But then at the same time, what comes out of this desperation and poverty, you see incredible resilience of the Indian people, but also innovation and really creative solutions to some of the community development problems and issues that India is targeting. And I think part of how I could sort of sit in that tension of having such confronting poverty is that at the exact same time, you have such a wealth of generosity and beauty. And it is hard at times, and it is a little bit overwhelming. I don't think that can be understated. But it's also, I think, realizing what you can do as a person to try and help those situations. And you would know all about this in your line of work with WizCom. But also just being aware of what you can't do and then focusing on the good as well as acknowledging the bad. And it is a tension. It's a balance. And I don't think you can ever fully get it right all of the time.
Yeah, and actually it's a good segue to what I wanted to bring up, because you know, when we talk about these things, these issues, so to speak, that India faces, the way I see it, I don't believe that any of it exists in a vacuum per se, and when we talk about anything which is a social phenomenon in India, like, for example, poverty, or for example, someone coming up to your car and asking you for money, right? That isn't exactly what it's like. It's not just like the answer to that isn't just, oh, there's poverty.
No,
you know what I mean? It's actually it's a very complex set of social and urban phenomena which is leading to that event happening. Anyway, I mean, all this to say, you know, both of you, especially Dr. Gopinath, you have obviously been in the policy and education space for so long, and I think more than any time before, you know, I'm not a believer that, you know, like, oh, you know, 2020 is a bad year. Like, you know, when people say like, oh, 2020 is awful, I just need this year to get over. Things were already pretty bad. And I think a lot of them are just coming to the surface because of the pandemic, right? Because of the pandemic, the things that are fundamentally wrong with the way we live are more salient than ever. So I don't know. I guess I want to know from both of you, you know, how your work has informed what you'd like to see changed about, you know, your community in Australia, or, you know, Dr. Gopinath, your immediate community in India. Just, you know, if we could just discuss that a little bit.
So, Ranak, before we segue into this, which is a very important thing, I was just struck by what you said about the several layers of reality that we confront every day, and how Ashley talked about the amazing inventiveness and innovation that still exists within what would be normally viewed as people with disadvantage, you know. Just to give you two examples, because she spoke about young kids coming up to you in your car, to your car while you're driving to, you know, ask for money. But, you know, these very same kids, they are so bright in terms of how they compute the algorithms that they know exactly. For example, if they are selling a newspaper on the street, so they're selling you something on the street, they will know exactly how much change to give back to you without having studied the three, you know, R's in a formal school setting. So there's something very, you know, there is a genius both in terms of survival and in terms of inventiveness. We call it the jugaad in India, but it's not just the jugaad. It's not just cutting and pasting, as it were, to use a normal, a modern analogy. But it's basically about coming to issues through a completely, through a lens of survival too. And I think that brings back this whole question that Ranak raised about COVID. You know, it's a new kind of adversity that even the global north is facing for the first time. It needs a completely even if you want to call it deprivation, a new kind, you know, unemployment, people being laid off, the conventional sociabilities sort of being lost. So is there something that can be learned from the so-called Indian, if there is indeed an Indian ways of looking, of life, living and being? You talked about resilience, you talked about hospitality in the midst of adversity. And the other thing is the ethics of care and sharing, which a lot of women are talking about now, because women, as you know, are in the front line of caregiving in this whole battle. They are the heroes in the front lines of battling this epidemic or pandemic, as you call it. So we are all our received definitions of, within quotes, well-being, security, advantage, economic stability, they're all being turned on their heads. And I think young people like you are going to give us a new vocabulary of living, and people like you really make despair unconvincing and hope practical. So as Ranak said, from this whole pandemic, what would be our collective, is there something in the Indo-Australian dialogue or dialogues that can throw up new ways of the way we imagine, say, the global architecture? There's a lot of talk today on the Indo-Pacific or the Pacific and a new Asia. Are we going to sort of define power, both economic and strategic, in the conventional sense? Or is this posing new both opportunities and challenges to us? So your generation can look at connectedness, the ethics of care, look at development in a completely different way, bridge the usual, sort of break down the north-south divides and the global boundaries that separate us. So that's a question Ranak has sort of compelled us to move towards. And Ashley, with your, you know, at such a young age, you have been on so many continents. You've also been in Thailand. You come to India and you want to go, I think you want to go to Myanmar. I mean, you sort of represent this amazing spirit of the millennials to break conventional boundaries. So I'd be so interested to know, how do you look at, say, this new emerging geopolitics, or how do you look at education as a vehicle for a new understanding of internationalism? all the questions that Ronak has asked, really.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on how COVID has essentially we've seen be this threat multiplier, and that it has made current threats and challenges worse, and then also just exposed, I think, the fragile nature of some of our systems in place, and exposed those really systemic inequalities that we've seen, you know, in India, in Australia, all across the world. And at the same time, yeah, you've seen states move towards a more nationalistic point of view, while what we really need is to maintain this focus of globalization. And I think the increased accessibility of everyone being forced to become very competent on the internet and on these new technologies that we're all meeting on, I think will help us in that. And it's an opportunity for us to engage more with people across the world, with our neighbours, with each other. I live in a regional city in Australia, and I've had opportunities here that I would not have had if COVID hadn't have happened, purely because things have now been moved online and are therefore more accessible to me. And I think using education as a vehicle in this pandemic and as we move through it will be essential. Education, there are so many benefits to educating, you know, women and girls, but also just every child. And you spoke before about you know, that little girl who's so talented with her maths, and I think that just shows the potential that we can bring out with education, as well as the, you know, education has numerous economic benefits in reducing women and gender inequality. There are so many things so many benefits to be seen, and things like climate change. So I think education needs to be at the discussion as we move at the forefront of this discussion as we move out of the pandemic.
I think one of the things that this has brought home to us is also the fact that Mother Earth's patience is dying out, and that we need to tread more lightly on the globe. And you know, you've had your forest fires. We've had our floods, and you know, all of these unprecedented damage because of what you might call natural calamities, but these are man-made in many ways. And so how do we go back and re-examine? You talked about more globalization, but do we need to put the earlier kind of globalization a little under the microscope? Do we need to look at a more humane globalization? Define that, because we are in the process of redefining development, you know, the SDGs for the first time have talked about beyond GDP development. You know, earlier development was always looked at through the lens of the GDP, but now with these 16 plus one goals, there is a realization that many of the problems that earlier just affected what was known as the global south is really knocking at the door of the global north as well. So those categories need to dissolve in the way we understand what, you know, I think Mary Robinson had talked about a more humane face to globalization. And coming back to what the pandemic has made a lot of people do, I know several of my friends, younger friends in the United States and Europe, are actually moving back in with their parents. And, you know, so there's a new understanding of the family away from that atomistic, right, Ronak?
Completely.
It's happening because people are finding a certain solidarity and a comfort and anchor in the traditional home. So as a young person, it would be interesting in this day of what you might call globalization, returning to the roots, what Gandhi would call Swadeshi, you know. It was not just spinning khadi, but what he would call taking responsibility or proximate environment, starting from where, you know, the micro and then moving on to the macro. How do you feel about that? You're doing that with Chris already, but like, you know, what would be the new notion of the family for you? Post-COVID, or if there is no post-COVID, at least the extended COVID and beyond. I think now we have to define global history as pre-COVID and COVID and beyond. So how would you, you know, respond to these issues I'm not looking at the old-fashioned family values discourse, but I'm talking about does it have a new valency now? You talked about connections. You talked about you're very strong on human connection. You talk about relationships a lot in your journey. So, how would young people like you redefine that whole individual versus community debate, or individual and the family debate?
It's a really interesting issue you've raised there, the individual and the family. And you're looking, you know, Australia, which at times is a very individualistic society. And I think that that really only gets you so far. And in terms of COVID and seeing these, you know, the problems that our societies were facing being made worse, I think it absolutely calls for a need to redefine and recreate some of these systems, because the way that we were addressing these problems, I think, aren't working as best they can be. And that's only evident, you know, that's evident by the statistics. And so I think COVID has called us all to reflect more on what we really value and what is important to us. Because at the end of the day, if you're forced to be at home, who do you want to be at home with? Do you want to be by yourself, or do you want to be with your family? And so I've had a similar experience in that I've had a lot of friends move back home and actually, you know, willingly choose to leave their apartments in the city and go to Melbourne. And it's not an economic decision for them. It's purely just, I want to be close to my family because I've realized how important they are to me. And I've probably been neglecting them for a little bit too long. And so I think that hopefully this pandemic will make us realize and have a newfound appreciation for each other and spending time for each other when we're, you know, also being told to stay at home and not socialize with friends. So I hope that coming out of this, we will see new systems redefined to have that holistic community ethical development start coming into place, and to have people caring about each other and actually valuing that time that we, you know, can spend together and have spent together in the past, but maybe have taken it for granted.
Dr. Gopinath, I really liked what you said about this idea of humane globalization, or a more conscious approach to globalization that goes beyond, you know, surface level interaction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we can start thinking about a more meaningful way to build this relationship in the Indo-Pacific, right? Beyond just, oh, you know, there's a couple of exchange programs, mm-hmm. but it can go so much deeper than that, especially if India as a country can leverage the immense potential, the immense research and policy potential that Australia has. If we can cross, if collaborations can happen in that sense, I mean, there's just so many powerful implications for that. The other thing I wanted to mention in relation to what you just said about, you know, families and the home as a space, and how women are really, you know, the ones who have made, who have supported the function, who have supported, you know, the fact that we can function during the pandemic. They're caregivers. They take care of the home. I mean, really, it's not discussed enough, you know, as a fundamental of daily life, that, you know, it's actually women who are supporting and making sure that the pandemic goes smoothly. Like, they are, you know, they're essential workers in that sense, right? But I think that's the tricky thing about, you know, our collective retreating into, you know, family homes and spaces, because, you know, I hate to be a skeptic about all this, but the way I see it is, I mean, it's a positive in a sense, but I see two negatives in a way. The first being that I think a lot of people closer to my age and younger, you know, in our mid-20s, the reason we are now living at home is not necessarily because we want to, but because we're forced to, because we're economically forced to, because so many of my friends have lost their jobs. You know, there's a record number of unemployment in India, the US, wherever. I mean, I'm not sure about Australia, actually, but there's a record high unemployment, right, in a lot of countries around the world. Not just that, but thinking even further about people who don't necessarily see the family home as a safe space, you know, thinking about queer people, or thinking about, you know, women who are abused by their husbands, or thinking about children who are abused by their parents. I mean, now they don't even have that escape of being able to leave the home, right? So one thing that really spiked in India post the lockdown, which was announced with 24 hours, not even 12 hours of notice, was that women who are, domestic abuse survivors can't leave the home. Children who are ostracized by their parents for being gay can't leave the house anymore. So now, that brings up a whole other host of complications, And that's one that I don't see it resolving itself very easily. But I do think that there can be someone else or an entity that steps in to take responsibility or to help alleviate those issues. I just don't know what exactly it looks like.
Those are such perceptive comments. Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. Every such situation has its upside, but it has a lot of downside to it. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, at the moment, what we are seeing are very, very, very bleak developments, both for women, especially. Mm-hmm. And, it's interesting that Australia was really the gold standard for women's rights. 1902, I think you got the franchise for women. And you were probably the first country that allowed women to stand for elected office. Second in terms of franchise, second to New Zealand, if I'm not wrong, but the first to give women the right to stand for elective office. And yet, for example, we've seen that the political space in Australia, certainly in India too, has not been very hospitable for women who aspire to political leadership. I mean, I don't want to give you specific examples. We all know that those might be. Mm-hmm. But there is this whole debate. And I think in Australia now, there is this debate in the third and fourth, what they call the third and the fourth wave of feminism, where there is I think in the second wave, you pretty much thought that you had settled the issues of differential wages for women and men, and that working hours for women, childcare for women, and all of that. But I think, again, and then you moved on to this whole issue of identity, sexuality, identities, which is very much a part of the debate even here in India, and the marginalization of people with different sexual identities. It's a huge, huge issue right now. But there's a return of domestic violence on account of COVID in India. I'm not sure about the figures in Australia. It's certainly exacerbated. We thought we had settled a lot of issues in 2012 after Jyoti Singh's brutal rape, and we had got the bill passed on sexual harassment at the workplace. But something has happened that has triggered a culture of impunity. Suddenly, yet again, we've seen a recent unfortunate happening in Hathras in UP, and also the shrinking in some senses of women's engagement at this broader structural level, possibly on account of the inability to mobilize on a large scale physically from these larger issues that Ronak spoke about. So how do we balance this quest for the freedom of identity along with larger democratic articulations, structural issues of patriarchy? These could be very important conversations that Australia and India still needs to have. So, as you said, climate change is a very important issue. Energy is a very important issue. The possibilities of the Indo-Pacific, not necessarily just limited to the Quad, but larger issues where we are looking at how do we redefine a new Asia, what does it mean for young people. But issues such as this, domestic violence, gender issues, and that brings us to the issue of women and leadership. What kind of leadership can women bring to the table that looks at an alternative vocabulary of power? Power not just as pushing down, but pulling up, and power not just in terms of armaments and military strength. And how does that work through education can education be the new soft power that we can both use to foment and expand relationships, relations? Australia has so much to offer at this juncture when India is debating its new education policy. You know, you had already spoken about, Australia had already looked at this whole issue of lateral entry, both vertical and horizontal, to bridge the gap between the vocational stream and what is known as the academic stream. It's already happened in terms of your own. And then, your dual sector universities and so on. But what really, impressed me about the Australian policy on education was that how it was so deeply invested in enabling every individual to go at least one notch above their present educational qualifications. So, not necessarily that everybody should go to the same kind of university, but that you push yourself at least one notch and then another notch and another notch. That's inbuilt into your educational policy. The other thing that's so exciting is how most of your universities are committed to at least a 25% foreign student presence. I know the state of Victoria is particularly invested in that idea of internationalization, multiculturalism. And it's not just, and I don't believe it's only an economic imperative. I don't think it's only about getting more fees from foreign students, no. Because when I visited, I was so struck by the way in which the city administration of Melbourne was so invested in the internationalization of education too. So they were both on the same page, the universities and the city administration, to enhance this whole idea of an expanding notion of education, where every individual would go one notch above theirs, and that where internationalization of education was built into the warp and weft of university policy. I think we are slowly opening up to that in India and thinking about, we need to have a much broader debate or a dialogue between India and Australia on what constitutes internationalization of higher education. As Ronak said, it's not just a few exchange programs or a few students coming over and going back and so on and so forth.
I think Australia and India both, yes, have absolutely a lot to learn from each other. And Australia, while we have some great successes, there are many areas that we still need to work on. In COVID, mental health, domestic violence, unemployment has, these things have skyrocketed and absolutely need change to be addressed. And I think that a partnership can come into play between these two countries. And sexism in Australia, it's almost as if it's taken a different form, in which people now know that it's, quite wrong to be sexist in Australia, but you've got this new form of modern sexism coming in, where it's this denial of women's discrimination and the ongoing discrimination that they face in Australia. And this comes out in them actually opposing policy reform and some of that gendered lens that we try to apply onto things. And so while, yes, we've made a great headway, there's still much work to be done. And I think India and Australia can partner together in that. And in terms of the mystic India, I think that it's quite a difference between the two countries, almost, in that India has so many different religions and so many different gods and so many different places of worship. And then in Australia, you've got a growing community of people that don't believe in a god at all. And so I remember meeting a lot of Australian and New Zealander students that are coming over and experiencing India for the first time. And I'd been there a couple months at this point, and they're just so shocked at how religion and faith and spirituality is it's at the heart of India. It's everywhere. I don't think you can go to India and not get inspired or at least impacted by this mystic side, this spiritual side. And I think it does cause you, and it does make you reflect, who am I? Why am I here? What's my purpose? What do I actually want to do with my life? And I think they're all really big questions that all of us should take the time to answer and to ponder. And I think particularly in Australia, sometimes those important questions get pushed to the side in just a matter of, I don't have to deal with it, they're not important. And then I think people do lose a bit of direction and they struggle to find that sense of meaning.
So I'm sure Ronit would also bring in a corrective here for us. That is that sometimes faith, of course, moves people's lives in so many ways in India, especially and in most of South Asia, I would say. But faith can also become a powder keg for distances between communities. And you, coming from Australia, that believes so much in multiculturalism, you must have found that, you know, in the smaller towns and villages, there is a kind of coexistence at work, but that there in the largest, in some places, coexistence is very frail. And as a young person, you know, and with your colleagues, we do hope that there will be some kind of a vocabulary where these kind of divisions can be overcome, you know, where a faith that can be a source of strength does not become end up becoming a divisive force. So there is that very fine balance between being being completely agnostic. It's good to be agnostic, and religiosity, which is not very good either. How does one keep that balance by coming back to the perennial principles of what makes us human? What is it that makes us human? And what is it that we take into the new world that you people like you are going to sculpt, and people like us can hope that the future is better than what we left for you. And I'm sure that with people like Rona, there will be new questions that emerge, because it's really about the questions that we ask, not other questions that we don't ask. And, you know, I thought, I just wanted to, I know we're coming close to the end of our time, but there was a lovely poem by, I think her name is Lucy Dugan. She's an Australian poet, and I think she's very popular. And she wrote this lovely little poem called Kindergarten Story. And I just wondered if I may just share a quote from that. Permission, Ronit.
Yeah, please.
And it was, it's called Kindergarten Story. And it says, there are windows stuck with stars and hybrid things. If you lie on the ground and look up, the sky strains in through cut-out clouds, uncertain zodiacs. Children with blunt scissors, small originators of these skies, tear out pieces of the world and stick them back again, refiguring whole constellations. So, you know, you will be refiguring whole constellations. And as I said, you will make despair unconvincing and hope practical. So COVID or no COVID.
And I think that poem, let's hope we do. And I think that poem can serve as a reminder for all, you know, people that are listening that, you know, are in towards the end of their career or right in the heart of their career, that it's important to bring young people along for the ride, and it's important to empower the next generation. You know, India would understand this, you know, your population is largely made up of young people. And Australia, we need to work on this, is actually having our young people involved in our political decisions, having a seat at the table where key and big decisions are being made. And I think that it's crucial to have youth and empower youth and to build up their leadership and their skills, so that when it does turn time to hand over the reins, that we can do it in a way that promotes equality, that fights for some of these things that we've been talking about, upholds human rights and supports and fights against some of the injustices that we've seen.
Isn't it fabulous that the Colombo Plan has thought about it in this way and gives you that context to go forward? A few countries have really engaged with this. There is a lot of talk, of course, also at the UN on youth. youth building peace, youth assessing development. But the Colombo plan really gives you that great opportunity. So congratulations.
It's a fantastic initiative. And I think it's very exciting that as another stream of the new Colombo plan allows every Australian undergraduate student to get academic credit and get a mobility grant, so some funding to allow them to go and on a study tour in the Indo-Pacific. And I think that this is where we need to start, you know, investing in more and more is building those people-to-people links, because you can tell someone about why it's important that we connect with our neighbours, and you can tell someone all about why India is amazing. And, you know, they may be inspired, but what will actually create that change is if they go and they experience it themselves and they meet the people and they encounter the culture and the climate and the country. And I think that that's where change can really start being seen, is when people feel it for themselves and then they're motivated because they know.